Hey.
So, hello, Glenn.
John McWhorter. I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. So, yeah. We're having our beer this afternoon.
Decided to have a beer
good.
In the commemoration of the fact that we're talking about race, and it looks like you can't do that well without a beer these days.
That's what one does, and so alcohol and blogging has. But, yeah, and obviously we have to talk about the Gates affair.
We are the black guys at BHTV, so yeah.
That's right. We have to do this one. And it seems to have reached a kind of calm point, and so it's actually something that we can comment on without being trumped by developments 12 hours later, which is the way all of it felt over the past couple of weeks.
Okay. Well, anyway, here's to your health as we get started.
Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's interesting. On the whole thing,
yeah.
What I think of is not trying to figure out what the evil psychology of people like Sergeant Crowley is, because I think there's an extent to which racist bias is part of being human. Not abuse, but I think to an extent it becomes a rather circular and futile discussion. All of these things, all of these profiling incidents or things that are processed as profiling incidents, make me always think of the war on drugs. And the reason for that is that the war on drugs forces police officers to pay a disproportionate amount of attention, particularly to young males of color, and it's because they are openly selling a kind of drug or drugs that are most prosecuted for various reasons. And as a result, the net ends up being cast, often cast too wide. Innocent black people are brought into it, including older black people, and so black men who are in their 50s have many complaints of being pulled over unjustly on drug searches. And it ends up making it so that there's a perception that the police are after, in particular, black men, and it creates the kind of tripwire responses that you saw from Gates in Cambridge. And of course, that was a very different situation. But when he says, "Why? Because I'm a black man in America," what he's tapping into is the same sort of thing that Tupac Shakur rapped about in his work. And it seems to me that if there were no war on drugs, then there would be no reason to concentrate attention upon young black men of color, particularly disadvantaged ones, in that way. And it would create certain ills in society, without a doubt. But I think that the metaphor about the omelet would come to mind. I think it'd be worth it because I think the main thing that's keeping us from moving towards being a post-racial nation is the relationship between black people and the police. I've said that and written that for a long time. So that's what this all reminded me of immediately, was the war on drugs.
Well, I mean, I agree with you that the war on drugs is bad policy. I've been saying it myself for a long time. I wonder, though, why you restrict attention to the war on drugs when the disproportion by race in criminal offending is not just with respect to drug trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's more violence, not all of which is related to drug trafficking, where blacks are perpetrators. Blacks are overrepresented,
mm-hmm,
as a statistical matter amongst people being tried for robbery and burglary and,
mm-hmm,
many other offenses. So you might have broadened I mean, again, I'm going to repeat, I think you're right about the policy mistake, which is the war on drugs,
mm-hmm,
and it certainly exacerbates. So if you wanted to just leave it there, I wouldn't complain, but,
mm-hmm,
this argument could be extended to a more general argument about the fact that in certain quarters of our society, for a host of reasons, including bad policies, but not only them, black men are overrepresented amongst criminal offenders, creating a circumstance in which the interaction between black men and police is fraught,
mm-hmm,
out of which incidents like this more readily arise. And,
mm-hmm,
I don't know, that seems to me, feels to me like it's a little bit more robust of an argument than just resting it all on the war on drugs.
Sure.
Though, again, for the third time, I agree with you about it being a policy,
sure,
mistake.
Yeah, and I would say that that's certainly the case. It seems to me that a lot of the things that we see fall out of the whole drug issue. So, for example, firearms. You know, it's not that young black men have some sort of fascination with guns that's disproportionate. A lot of that is about defending turf and gang wars that are about your territory for selling drugs. And this also goes with robberies, with murders, their gangs, where committing some sort of random murder, often even of a young person, is the price of initiation. It's part of how you show. All these things tend to grow out of the gang/turf culture, which is undergirded a lot by the drug sales. But yes, there's a lot of...
It's hard to say what's cause, what's effect. War on drugs is certainly a big part of it. There would probably be a Crips and a Bloods if there were not a war on drugs. Mm-hmm. The Crips and the Bloods predate the war on drugs,
et cetera.
But this argument has an interesting feature, which is that you end up, like Heather McDonald, your colleague at the Manhattan Institute, mm-hmm. in that piece of hers that I've seen, you know, you end up going down the list, you know, how many murders are committed, how many, you know, you end up calling attention to, quote, black criminality, close quote. In other words, you end up putting a color on crime. And even if the statistical overrepresentation, just as it is, let's say, with respect to welfare recipients, mm-hmm. there's going to be a statistical overrepresentation, mm-hmm. you might say most blacks are not criminals, even if relatively more criminals are black.
Mm-hmm.
Most blacks are not criminals. That's really not a kind of narrative that we want to be encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
We want to be realist and acknowledge what's going on in the world, but we don't want to freight too much on the racial disproportion in offending, because it seems to, as it were, blame the victim.
Sure. And I think, frankly, a lot of people writing about that sort of thing, what they mean by implication is something like black families have to take their children in hand or something like that.
Well, that's what the president says. That's what the president of the United States says.
Yeah, and that's a nice line, and it's a nice thing to say. But, of course, it can't be the whole story, because it's just like having beer at the White House. What is it really going to do?
I hear you. Okay, so then let's focus on that for a minute, because the president went to the NAACP
mm-hmm.
just a few weeks ago
mm-hmm.
and gave a big speech. It was, you know, much reported. And he didn't talk about the war on drugs in that speech. He talked about the thing that you just got through talking about,
mm-hmm.
which is good to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Families, responsibility, fathers, take care of your children, and so forth and so on. But what he didn't talk about as the president of the United States was policies over which he could exert no small influence that actually are at work here, which is his business. His business is not head preacher.
Mm-hmm.
Is not chief moralist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's supervising the government of the United States, and he's framing the national discussion about our laws. So the president of the United States is letting us down, I want to say here.
Mm-hmm.
He fails to provide appropriate leadership on the question of race
mm-hmm.
because he repairs to a set of nostrums about these problems, which are of which this beer summit is really just, you know, the least of it. I mean, I want to know what he's doing to end the war on drugs, or why he won't talk about it. Well, I know the answers to those questions. It has to do with politics.
Mm-hmm.
Shame on him. What do you say to that, John McWhorter?
First of all, I think we have to remember that the first half of that speech was about statistics that we're all familiar with, and he did mention that, you know, black people have it harder than white people in many cases. Then he did the part about no excuses. And, of course, because it was easy and because it was media-friendly, that's what got around. But I don't think that he was solely giving a Bill Cosby kind of speech.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying he didn't talk about the policies that you're mm-hmm. calling attention to that are implicated in this matter.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. When I have brought up the war on drugs, and it's something that I'm going to start working on harder as my life transitions over the next couple of years, I have found that there is an almost frightening hostility against the notion of getting rid of the war on drugs among many people, and it's not only lacquer-haired Republicans. There are many people who cannot imagine that you would actually go down a very different road. It's interesting, in terms of response that I get where the fury is counterintuitive. One of them is this little line I've gone off on in recent months where I've said that we need to start thinking about making Shakespeare's language more accessible in terms of the modern layer of our language, because in real time, listening to it, it is virtually incomprehensible in many passages. People get angry about that as if I suggested that I was going to eat their own children with a fork and a knife. The other thing like that is the war on drugs. People just start, you know, fuming like Mr. Mooney on the Lucy show. And the fact of the matter is, obviously, there would be some harms. And there's dueling evidence, I'm not sure which is authoritative, but that addiction rates might go up in some quarters.
Yeah,
but
I'm gonna
sound kind of like you on this. I think that if America was going to make some sort of commitment to solving these sorts of social problems, and you can call them black problems, you can call them problems of the underserved, if there was going to be some sort of final covenant, if that happened, I would say that ceasing the war on drugs would be a vital thing to do, because despite certain unpleasant byproducts, if you pulled a leg out from under that particular economy, I think it would create a seismic change in black communities.
And
I think that it would be a social experiment worth trying. I'm not trying to blame anybody for anything, because it's too uncomplicated. These things are a matter of all sorts of life factors. But if you couldn't make that choice, if there were no such thing as, I'm not going to do X, Y, or Z, I'm going to go hang out with my friends and sell drugs and maybe I'll make my way up. If you couldn't, because you could buy those things at the store or with a prescription, it would really change things. I think it would create different kinds of incentives. I'd like to see it.
Okay, well, we agree about the war on drugs. Maybe we should talk about another aspect of the problem. So you say Gates's motives might have had to do with this awful situation that all black men, even of the most elevated station, are in virtue of this dynamic that's going on between the police and African-American men, of suspicion and confrontation and so on. Does that exhaust it? Did you see Shelby Steele in the Wall Street Journal? Well, I know you must have seen Shelby Steele in the Wall Street Journal.
You caught me. You mean today?
Oh, no. I don't know when it ran. Not too many days ago. I got an email link a couple of days ago. Okay, so
I'm embarrassed. See, I was on vacation and I wasn't at the computer all day.
You're forgiven for not. Anyway, Shelby Steele argues that Gates repairs to a... He compares the Gates incident to the Emmett Till incident. Okay, Emmett Till, who was lynched in the 1950s,
right.
Famously.
I'm waiting to hear how...
The body was buried with an open coffin, even though it was partly decomposed or badly bludgeoned.
Horrible.
And they had photographs in the Jet magazine.
Yeah.
I still remember seeing them when I went to a barbershop when I was 7 years old or 8 years old. And Shelby tells this very story of going to the barbershop. He's a couple of years older than me, I think, when he was 8 years old or 9 years old. This is like 1956 or 1957 or something. And seeing the photographs of, you know, they said, don't show it to him, don't show this. The older men didn't want the kid to see these terrible photographs, but anyway, he got his eyes on them and they left an impression on him. And he was saying, you know, that was victimization. Okay? You know, that narrative about lynching somebody for recklessly eyeballing, whistling at, or being fresh with a white woman, beating this kid from the north, from Chicago, to death because he'd gone down to Alabama or Mississippi and had behaved socially inappropriately in public vis-a-vis a white woman, that was real victimization. And that's kind of entered into the canon. And, you know, Gates is drawing on the kind of moral authority that's engendered from this history of black victimization by, in some sense, associating himself with that kind of narrative. Although, he goes on, of course, Shelby Steele does, to say, things have changed a great deal since then. And whereas in the 1950s there really was that kind of an issue, today it's something else altogether again. It's like props in some kind of public drama, you know, or trope or whatever the right literary word would be, that you trot out in order to try to gain moral authority in a situation that really isn't anything like raising those kind of deep questions of race in the society. And I'm just, you know, so this is a Shelby Steele argument. He's been making it for, you know, 20 years, one guy's or another. And I've gotten tired of it when I hear it coming from him, except on this particular occasion it really didn't ring true, I must say.
Yeah, I mean, he's on to something, and there are people who exaggerate about this kind of thing. I think there is a sense among some black men that, you know, you're not really in the club unless you can tell a story about the police bothering you, and I think people have a way of chiming in. Shelby's interesting. He gave a talk out in California once, where it was to undergraduates, and he had the usual clack of undergraduates who had come to hate on him.
Yeah.
And one of them said, well, if there's no more racism, then how come whenever I'm driving around in town, the police follow me just because I'm black? And Shelby just said, you're lying. And frankly, likely he was. I mean, it's not like that. The kid was lying. And so there is some of that.
No, I wish I could have been there to see that. I get that completely.
It was quite extraordinary.
So is Gates lying?
No, Gates is not lying at all. I think that he was afraid. He was annoyed. I can imagine how I would feel if I were coming back from China. But you know what's interesting is something I don't have an answer to, and it's something that you get in the comment sections of things you write about this when it comes up, which is that a lot of white people's view of this sort of thing is, well, the cops aren't nice to us either. And, for example, I live in Jersey City, and Jersey City's got some bad press lately. I'm going to give it some more. The cops in this city are some of the meanest sons of bitches I have ever encountered.
Okay.
They seem to enjoy annoying people. I have had offensive encounters with quite a few over the 4 years I've lived here, and I must admit that every time I have one, I think to myself, does this have anything to do with the fact that I'm black? But the fact of the matter is, I've watched those cops treating white people pretty meanly too, including my own wife, and so clearly there's an extent to which cops just get surly because of the nature of their job. Then on the other hand, you can't dismiss the fact that there are certain things that seem to happen to black people a lot more often because that they are looking for a black person for reasons that may start out with legitimate.
Yeah.
But then if Charles Ogletree is the one who gets pulled over, Harvard law professor, something's wrong. So I don't know where to draw the line on that.
I heard something really funny the other day. Somebody was saying, Gates gets arrested on his own front porch. What an outrage.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone else says, Gates manages to get arrested on his own front porch. What an accomplishment. by which I'm saying, it's probably not the easiest thing to do, is it?
No. And do you think they should have arrested him?
Oh, no, I do not. I agree with what I heard Colin Powell quoted as having said, which is that even if the officer on the scene in the face of an obstreperous reaction from a civilian who felt that he wasn't being respected pulled out his cuffs and arrested the party in question for disorderly conduct.
Mm-hmm.
The station chief back at headquarters, you know, they're in constant radio contact,
mm-hmm.
ought to have remanded that order.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And said, exactly. No, take the cuffs off of him and leave him be.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you, he's an asshole if that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
But no, leave him be. You know, cooler heads, I think Colin Powell's construction was adult supervision should have prevailed,
mm-hmm.
something
exactly.
like that. I agree with that. No. Of course he ought. It was not good policing to arrest this individual in his own home because
mm-hmm.
he was back-talking a police officer.
No.
I would have been outraged if that had happened to me. Still, what I'm saying is if you put yourself in the situation, I mean, after all, the African-American officer on the scene has, you know, et cetera, come out and said that he thought it was appropriate to do the arrest and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's not inaccurate to say that's not an easy thing to do, to get arrested on your own front doorstep. You really have to put some effort forward to achieve that outcome.
Yeah. You know, it's a sad thing. It's interesting. Last summer, I had a Jersey City cop issue. I was coming home in a cab, and the driver took a wrong turn, and it was a hot night, and basically the man was clearly enjoying stopping me and the driver, who was black, probably Senegalese, holding us there as long as possible, talking to us both as if we had broken into a liquor store or had yelled at him on a porch. I mean, just a nasty, nasty little person.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether it was racial or not, again, I always think of something else. I always think of the war on drugs. I thought, I can handle this. You know, I'm a 42-year-old man. I'm enjoying my life more than this person. He can't break my stride. This is just, I'm going to walk home, and I did. But I thought, can you imagine a teenager of 12 or 13, black kid from the projects, running into that guy? And especially because he has to run into him every week or two often. That will fix you for life in terms of how you feel about the wider world, how
sure.
you feel about white people. Those are the only white people a lot of those kids know. And I thought to myself, the war on drugs means that this guy ends up creating little black boy's sense of what the larger world is. And next thing you know, to be hyperbolic, that boy's in jail because he doesn't think of the world as his. And so it's a very unpleasant thing, even if that guy treats white people the same way. I mean, that's not a watertight argument. But, yeah, there are problems with the police in general and the war on drugs if it's just a general police
problem.
Okay,
so here's what bothers me about this whole affair. It gets us talking about ephemera, and it's so highly symbolic. It gets us talking about the froth that's on the surface, and not about the deeper structure of social relations. And it's so symbolic. Okay, so black man, this is what happens to a black man in America. Black men, this is just a big abstraction. I'm a black man with a PhD. You've got people now, you know this, writing on these blogs. I saw a post from Larry Bobo, the professor at Harvard, to this effect. What do they call a black man with a PhD? Well, that's the old joke. You know, they call him nigger, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they call a black man with a PhD. Ha, ha, ha. That's the old joke.
Never heard that joke before, right?
That was, yeah, that, I heard that coming up in Chicago in the 50s and 60s all the time, and it was true. In the 50s.
Yeah.
But there isn't any such thing as an abstract black manhood that's subject to generalized suspicion and police repression. Some people actually have PhDs, own houses on Martha's Vineyard and other such places, and live very comfortable lives in which they mainly have all the cultural authority that anybody could possibly have. They may have an unpleasant incident driving back from the airport late at night or whatever it might be with a taillight out, but their lives are not driven by the coercive imposition of state power. Other people who are black and brown in this country live under the constant imposition of state coercive authority, suspicion, detention, harassment, and other such actions. There's not a generalized experience of black men here. There's the intersection of race and class. And what drives me crazy is that the public megaphone gets put up to the mouth of a few privileged people who then get to engage in a kind of identity discourse about what it feels like to be, you know, to have all the degrees in the world and to still be black. Well, get over it is almost what I want to say. And by the way, would you take some of your time and effort and your privilege and direct your attention to the circumstances of the vast majority of your co-racialists who are living under very different conditions and having to deal with a very different reality? I mean, the notion that Gates is now going to make a documentary film about racial profiling based on his personal experience, when the intersection between race and the policing in this country largely has to do with handcuffs getting slapped on to 19-year-old kids, getting thrown into the back of police transporters, and getting driven out to Rikers Island.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality. The reality is lower working class, urban, ghetto-bound, poorly educated, intermittently employed, marginal people being policed, not Harvard professors. The president's friend. The president dares to talk in terms of his friend. When he gets around to addressing race and the policing, it's in terms of his friend and his own imagined experience if he were to be caught breaking into the White House because he forgot his keys. Mm-hmm. That disgusts me. That's not very good political leadership in this country of a progressive president who's supposed to be addressing himself to the basic fundamental issues of inequality and power in the society.
Glenn, what would you say if you said what you just said to me in quite a few spaces, even, you know, around Harvard Yard, and somebody, black male, objected from the back with a certain resonant cadence and a certain coloration of vowels, which I cannot summon. But if what he said
you're doing a pretty good job, though.
Where what he ended it with was, what happens when you get pushed up against the wall by the cops? Do you feel so separate? And remember, he has the cadence, and half the room starts clapping.
Yeah.
How would you respond? Because you're saying that if Larry Bobo has been pulled over by the cops a couple of times, well, that just doesn't matter. I think he would beg to differ. Would you say that he's just being a drama queen? What would you say to somebody?
Okay, so, you know, all of the moral authority that would go with that performance that you just got through describing so aptly would be at play there. And I would have to concede something. I would have to say, yeah, brother, I know what you mean, although maybe I wouldn't say it quite that way, but I would say, I would acknowledge that that's definitely a downer, and it's definitely real. It's real. It's real. It happens, and it's bad. It's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, in the array of offenses, and this is McWhorter-esque as far as I understand it.
I know. You sound like me.
You know, when you think about what racism is and what it can be, it's not perfect. It would be much better if you never had that experience. But come on. That doesn't change the facts on the ground. Doesn't change that I got a PhD. Doesn't change that I keep a summer house in the New Hampshire mountains, if I do, or whatever it might be. And while one wants to object to it strenuously, mm-hmm. one wants not to let the tail wag the dog. One wants mm-hmm. not to have one's framing of public discourse, and this is where I indict the President of the United States, let it to be driven mm-hmm. by that kind of personal reaction. It's a little bit like this. It's a little bit like, okay, one of the arguments against affirmative action is that if you get it, if it exists, then even people who didn't need it will be suspected of having benefited from it.
Mm-hmm.
It's true.
Which they will. Yes.
It's true.
Yeah.
And it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a reason not to have affirmative action, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
There may be other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the argument that comes from the person who could have gotten into MIT without a thumb on the scale, who happens to be black, who says, I don't want any affirmative action because it degrades my thing, there's something a little cheesy and self-important about that argument, in my opinion. Not that it's false, just that it doesn't quite register with the same degree of salience
mm-hmm.
when we're thinking about what should be public policy. Again, let me say it. There could be many reasons not to have affirmative action, but I don't think that that would be anywhere near the top of the list. Likewise, there are many, many issues going on with policing, far from the in blacks and race and police power and law in this country. I think you put your finger on one of the important ones, which is how we deal with drug control policy. But, you know, the racial profiling of BMW driving million-dollar-a-year-earning celebrities is not one of them. So anyway, I was saying there are many reasons to be worried about race in the policing and the inconveniencing of the top 1% of the African American income earning mm-hmm. population who is male are way down the list of the reasons that should be
in the
discussion, in my opinion.
I quite frankly, when I listen to a black man talking about quote unquote what it's like to be a black man in America, and he makes several tens of thousands of dollars a year, lives a comfortable life, has degrees, et cetera, et cetera. And what he's talking about is something that happened to him 3 years ago, and often it's something as ambiguous as what happened to Henry Louis Gates. I see it. I don't scorn it the way I think, say, Shelby Steele does, but I see it as a kind of a quest for identity. I think it's there's a sense of validation that some people get from joining the oppressed group. There's a kind of an underdog complex. That's human. It manifests itself in many ways. I think that, yeah, if the president were going to pay attention to something, it should not be that someone like you or me occasionally has an uncomfortable 20 minutes. It's about people who live with it throughout their lives. And, yeah, it's interesting. You seem very impatient for Obama to come out and address these kinds of problems, and I think I'm more indulgent only because there is the economy. Because if we want to talk about being post-racial, there is a health care issue, and it doesn't make for as tasty news as something that happens on Skip Gates' front porch. But it's very important, and I think that he wants to concentrate on those things. And, of course, also to show the nation and the world that he is the leader of the free world, as we used to call it, as opposed to somebody with what could be seen as parochial concerns. I would give him 4 years. If after 4 years, when the economy stabilizes at least to some extent, if after 4 years he hasn't made any more serious efforts to address race than the symbolic sorts of things he's done so far, I'll feel like you. But I'm a little surprised that you would expect, especially given current conditions, that he would run right in and start messing with things like drug policy, sentencing policy, and the like.
Okay. I hear you, John, and I think what you say is quite fair, and it may be that I'm being unfair to the president. That is to say, he's got a very full plate. That is to say, he's got scarce political capital that has to be husbanded. That is to say, he's got priorities, and, you know, healthcare reform and, the economic recovery and so forth are much more important than these other things. And that is to say, it's a little bit Pollyanna-like to go around saying from the left, why doesn't the president come out of a far-left agenda, that's how ending the war on drugs or reducing the prison enrollment rates or, you know, mm-hmm. whatever would be seen. So I agree that one ought to judge his leadership in a larger context, and I may have credited just a moment ago, but I just want to say this. He did talk about race. Okay, he went to the NAACP mm-hmm. and he gave a speech. What I'm saying is there was some stuff that was left out of the speech, namely how policies which he might himself influence have contributed to this situation and need to be changed. Okay, how can he do that and do the other thing too? Maybe he couldn't. What I'm saying is he gave a press conference. And he did take up the issue of race in the press conference when he came to the defense of, quote, his friend, close quote. Robert Gibbs, the White House spokesman, has already confirmed that they anticipated and in some measure prepared for a question about the Gates affair. So this was a, to some degree, premeditated response that was given. And I think it was a misstep. And I think the president, to this extent, is mishandling. He gets all this credit for knowing how to talk to the country about race. He gave that speech in Philadelphia back during the campaign a year and some ago in which everyone said it was a great speech about race. In my opinion, to the extent that the president is handling a portfolio about race at all, he's mishandling it in this most recent incident in which he burnt political capital. There can be no doubt about that. For nothing, as far as I'm concerned, is one more piece of evidence that he's not nearly as deft at handling the racial conversation, which is now almost completely in his hands. He is the agenda setter. He's the conductor of the orchestra here. He's the guy who's going to frame how the country talks about this, and he needs to get it right.
Well, you know,
he hasn't gotten it right.
I think both of us are familiar with the fact that race is not something that always brings out the coherent or the graceful in people. And as Shelby Steele, I think, has most articulately put it, we talk about race in such coded ways that it can be difficult to talk about it, partly because we're trained not to say what we mean. Like, even think of the term affirmative action. What the hell does that mean? Affirming what? You know, what a set, nested term that is for what affirmative action actually consists of. That's the way it is. And I think even Obama is thrown by it at times. It would be surprising if he wasn't, given that he has a very artfully constructed racial identity. And I think that what he said was a little bit of Obama, the human being, trying to have his black bona fides. And I can understand why he would do it. I can imagine doing the same thing in that position.
There is that
guy in the back of the room. It's the stand-up comedian. It's the professor. That person who's always waiting there, if only metaphorically, to say, what happens when you get stopped by the cops? And then everybody laughs. I'm sure Obama has watched that person in action. He feels that person watching over his shoulder.
John, I apologize for interrupting. I got a little disk space on my hard drive here, and I'm going to crash any moment.
Oh,
so we got a problem. I think we need to terminate our conversation.
Want to wrap it up?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Glenn?
Yeah. Sorry about the unevenness of this, but there you are.
It happens to me, too.
Yeah.
And so I think this was still a good conversation.
Indeed.
And let's keep it going and get that thing fixed.
Okay. Let's talk again before the summer is out.
Very good.
Take care.
You too.
Bye.